Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. We are going to be chatting today about history. Do you like going back into the past? Are you interested perhaps in hearing about screaming warlords in China and maybe some military facts or that talks about the ins and outs of both American military and Chinese military? How about dipping back into a period of time of Chiang Kai-shek and others, and also a time when aviation was right in its infancy and a whole world was going to be opened up due to aviation? Well, my guest today, Gregory Crouch, he is a man that has taken on a project that I don't think when he started it, he even had an inkling of where it was going to take him. Gregory Crouch, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. It's a pleasure to speak to you this afternoon.
Well, I was intrigued with your background. I want my audience to know about it. You graduated from West Point, and you had a love of history when you were at West Point. You studied it quite diligently. You also were involved with the U.S. Army Airborne and Ranger Schools. You led an infantry platoon in Panama. You've won medals. You decided to become a writer. And before we went on air, you were talking to me about this fabulous book, China's Wings. And I'm just absolutely amazed at the artistry that went into the book itself. But your words at the very beginning, war, intrigue, romance, and adventure in the Middle Kingdom during the Golden Age of Flight. That is tremendously gripping in its verbal description. Gregory, how did this project come about? What made you decide that you were going to spend what you described as almost 2 years just researching this information? Because all of this is true information.
Yeah, well, this is a true story. It's about William Langhorn Bond and the China National Aviation Corporation, which was an airline partnership between the nationalist Chinese government of Chiang Kai-shek and Pan Am, that flew and fought in China in the 1930s and 40s. And I discovered the story through a climbing partner. I come from a really active mountaineering and rock climbing life or world at the time. And this friend of mine, Charlie Fowler, who had two climbing obsessions in life, one was mountains in Patagonia and the other was unclimbed mountains in China, came back from one of his trips to China and sent me an email saying, hey, I keep hearing stories about these old World War II American plane wrecks in the eastern Himalayas. You're a military history guy, a mountaineer, and a writer. You should get a story sparked up on that. And when I followed up on his lead there and was doing web searching, I kind of knew that it would be related to the hump flying in the Second World War, which was, you know, the United States airlifting supplies from India over the eastern spur of the Himalayas into China. I stumbled across this website for China National Aviation Corporation, CNAC.org. And as I was sort of paging through the many, many pages of that website and the story was taking shape for me, I was getting more and more enthusiastic about it. And then I hit their reunions page. And I looked at it closely, and they were having their reunion in San Francisco, which is only about 20 miles from where I live in Walnut Creek, and it was only 3 weeks from then. So I called up the president of the CNAC Association, Bill Mahar, who was an old CNAC pilot, an old hump pilot, and I explained to him what I wanted to do, and I was looking into the possibility of writing a book about their airline. Could I come to their reunion and meet them? And he's this, you know, crotchety 85-year-old guy. He's like, hell yes, come on down. So I went and spent a long weekend with all these old pilots, and not just pilots, but many of the ground personnel and operations personnel who'd worked with the airline. And At the end of the 3 days, as I was driving home, I was physically shaking. I couldn't believe that I'd discovered a story that good on one hand, and on the other, that the room wasn't crawling with writers.
Isn't it amazing? You meet people that have lived this incredible experience. None of this ever gets into schools. Students never know about it. And when you have a chance to interview some of these people, they say, I'd be delighted. They're not isolationists. They're happy to share their story.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Donna. The key is to ask, though. I've had several of the sons and daughters of the CNAC people, you know, sort of sit in and on interviews when I was interviewing their fathers. And at the end, they'd be like, oh, my God, Dad never said any of that stuff before.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be like, well, did you ever ask? And that sort of, you know, set them on their ear. And that was the bottom line, is they were unwilling to talk about it. It's just that they weren't going to, you know, stand on a soapbox and go off on their own. So they needed the prompting.
They wanted to have a conversation. And here you are, a military guy, West Pointer, and you have all of this background. So they think you can speak the language and understand their language.
Well, I don't think the military background was so key, but I just had done so much research into their airline, so I was very much able to ask them specific questions. And, of course, you know, they're going to give specific answers, and that's how you get a good interview out of somebody, is actually doing a little bit of prep work to it, you know, so that
mm-hmm.
you are pretty coherent in what you're asking. And indeed, I was very persistent with some of the, you know, more important main supporting characters in the book who were still alive. Bond, my main character, great guy, but he died in the 70s and I never got to meet him. I'm sorry, died in the 80s and I never got to meet him. But the other ones, you know, I would go back to them with very specific questions if something wasn't clear to me, you know, time and time again. And they were all very patient with me. And it took me a long time to realize that I was sort of giving them something that they really wanted too, which is to have their story told. You know, it was a great partnership.
You have so many levels of information, fascinating information. You are just an awesome writer. The details that you give right in the very beginning of the book that set up the stage for what is evolving, because at this time, when these airline agreements had been put together between the United States and China, aviation was just beginning to really come into its own. But I loved how you talked about the Yangtze River, how it was the most powerful force governing the evolution of Chinese culture, which is not something that I think many people are aware of. Also that Shanghai was an extremely important port. And you mentioned in the book that it was the fifth busiest port in the world. And you talk about the Cossacks, bodyguards for the rich Chinese, the white Russian refugees flooding into Frenchtown when Lenin's Bolsheviks seizing power. Here is all of this phenomenal drama that is going on simultaneously.
Well, Shanghai has the most amazing municipal history. I really fell in love with Shanghai when I began researching the CNAC project, or this book, China's Wings. And CNAC, the airline, was hubbed out of China, or I'm sorry, out of Shanghai. It was their hub. And it was by far the most commercially important city in China in the 1920s and 1930s. And the 30s is the era that my book starts in, 1931. And with the result of the Opium Wars that the British had won against the Chinese in the 19th century, they'd got, you know, won these trading concessions from the Chinese, or wrestled them from the Chinese, and Shanghai was one of them. But Shanghai wasn't even a city in 1842 and 43 during the First Opium War. It was just a swamp on the banks of the Wangpu River, which is, you know, near the mouth of the Yangtze. And then this fabulous city grew up out of this swamp because of the trading concession and you know, trading opium and silks and porcelains. And there was this foreign enclave, the international settlement, which was kind of the British and the Americans had merged their trading concession, and then the French concession adjacent to it. And taken together, they were about the half the size of Manhattan Island. And around them sprang up this immense city, you know, Greater Shanghai, because they were doing great business there. And so Shanghai is the newest place in China, and it's always been the cutting edge of change since, you know, the middle of the 19th century. And it's still that today. It's still a tremendously important and muscular commercial city.
I was astonished when I read in your book that by 1872, the Chinese were the majority of the population in Shanghai, and they paid most of the taxes, but at the same time, you called them disenfranchised. Yeah. However, they felt like they were in financial heaven because of the way the Chinese government taxed, and there was the tyranny that was executed by the Manchu group, and they felt like they were protected being in Shanghai because the Western powers were there.
Well, yeah, the deal with the Shanghai Municipal Arrangement was pretty fantastic. They set the Shanghai Municipal Council governed the international settlement. And it was elected if you were a foreign taxpayer. So if you were white and paid taxes, you could vote. And if you were Chinese and paid taxes, you could not. But that had the brilliance of that system was it removed foreign Shanghai from the control of the colonial office back in London, right? So mm-hmm. Shanghai was kind of the lunatics running the asylum, and they ran it for profit. And it was fabulously successful. Now, the reason the Chinese wanted to live there is because of the British respect for property rights. You know, they did not get their possessions expropriated at gunpoint or sword point like they were prone to. You know, the Chinese don't really have a functioning legal system, certainly not in the same way that the British do. So if you were a well-to-do Chinese or a Chinese person at all living in the foreign concessions, although you didn't get to vote, your property rights were respected. So they were very popular places to live, you know, particularly whenever like a paroxysm of violence would rack the Chinese countryside, say like the Taiping Rebellion in the 1850s and 60s, or, you know, the warlord period in the 1910s and 20s before the rise of the nationalists. You know, Chinese people flocked to Shanghai to kind of secure their assets under the aegis of Western protection.
In this book, which is about this phenomenal man, Bond, I was so impressed with the way you portrayed his character. He was a bachelor at the time that he had the opportunity to go overseas and to work in China. Give us a little bit of background on this man, because he had impeccable integrity.
Yeah, you know, that was the cornerstone of his success in China, was his integrity. Now, he was just a little bit shy of 40 when he arrived in China on St. Patrick's Day in 1931. He'd been born in 1893. He volunteered when the United States entered the Great War in 1917. Became an officer, a lieutenant, and he served in an artillery battery. And then after the war, he'd worked in a heavy construction concern. He never went to college and sort of rose into a management position in that company, you know, building road beds and tunnels and bridges throughout Appalachia in general, because he was from Petersburg, Virginia. And when Lindbergh flew the Atlantic, he was inspired by that, and he wanted to get into aviation, which was by far the most exciting technology industry of the era. And so through a family connection, he caught on with Curtiss Wright, which was the original airline, Western airline, American airline, that was partnered with the Chinese, and Pan Am bought them out in 1933. And Bond built a factory for Curtis Wright, and then they needed somebody to represent them in this airline in China, and the persons that they'd sent over there before had proved unable to work with the Chinese effectively, and the family connection that had gotten Bond the job sent him off to China knowing that he was well-mannered and fair, right? And, and that was the sort of beginning of his career in China, and he just built from that. He built relationships with the Chinese that were very successful because he was fair. You know, he would treat a person as they deserved to be treated, regardless of what skin color they had, and that was very much appreciated by the Chinese. And they, you know, it became a trap too because he couldn't get out of China because Pan Am wouldn't let him leave because the strength of his relationships with the Chinese was so strong.
Yes. And he understood their culture very, very well.
Yeah, yes. You know, and he just treated them as individuals. You know, he didn't have to like all of them, and he certainly didn't, you know, kiss their backsides. But, you know, if a guy treated him right, Bond treated him right in return. And that was very appreciated and actually a very rare skill. Many of the Caucasians working in the Far East at that time were not capable of doing that.
Absolutely true, and that was something that caused them more headaches than not. Now,
you know,
there's so much that you talk about. You talk about the Yangtze River and how it at one point swelled, and this was just when he came in. This man witnessed China in its rawest form, in its most unsophisticated form, as well as seeing its exquisiteness of beauty. This is a time when communism is starting up. There's all kinds of revolts, but this is a country, as big as it was, that was just totally unable to really communicate, and that's something that Chiang Kai-shek, you have a quote in here, China is one of the largest countries in the world, but owing to no small degree to the lack of communication facilities, she is not yet thoroughly unified. That was in 1931 when Chiang Kai-shek said that. And you look at the world today with all of our technology, and they're still trying to disconnect. So many people in power don't want the technology to open up the lines of communication. But there's a lot of areas in China people don't. Well, I remember reading something where the people, once the great empress of China died, the last one, it was years before anybody in the countryside even knew what happened.
Yeah, you know, that's true. China, in, you know, say, in the early years of the 20th century, you know, they were building railroads and struggling to build roads. The rivers were the main arteries of communication in China, and that's why the Yangtze is so important. You know, it just flows right through the heart of the most densely populated rural landscape in the world, which is, you know, the lower Yangtze Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the prime artery of communication, all the creeks and rivers and canals that flowed into it. That was how commerce moved. And so the big cities, the most important commercial cities, had grown up on its banks. You know, Shanghai, Nanking, Kuching, Hangzhou, Chongqing. Those are all sort of major cities on the way up the Yangtze. And CNAC, but the problem with those communications is they were not fast. And it takes years and vast capital sums to build railroads and highways where you, relatively cheaply you could drop in an airline, particularly flying boats, because the airlines were using the river as its airports in the beginning, and just quickly fly up and establish these airmail routes and passenger routes. And they were very successful at that in the beginning. It was a very valuable service to China and very much helped knit, you know, the further flung cities to the nationalist power base in Nanking, because that was their capital, right? Chiang Kai-shek's capital was Nanking, just in the lower Yangtze Valley, not Peking or Beijing as it's today in the north.
You bring up the information also about the financial devastation in the United States, but it was the Depression as we know it. You go into more information about how Britain defaulted on her gold payments, and it absolutely was devastating to the international gold standard, and that's when the United States started getting into trouble because people started making runs on the bank. And you also talk about how during this time frame that the Chinese were boycotting Japanese goods and business, and the Japanese weren't happy about that, but the Japanese were not only planning on invading the U.S., they were planning on taking over China.
Well, I don't think they were planning on invading the United States at that time. Their whole war aim was about controlling China. In 1931, they had annexed the three Manchurian provinces. So Manchuria had been annexed and sort of made into a new country, Manchukuo, with a Japanese puppet government in charge. And now the Chinese, in response, because they didn't have the military power to confront the Japanese, they boycotted Japanese businesses. Now there's a very big Japanese presence in Shanghai in the 1930s, and this what's called the Shanghai War of 1932 sprung up there, where the Chinese and the Japanese fought a pretty massive battle in the northern districts of Greater Shanghai in 1932. And you know, that was one of the things where CNAC really made its bones, because the fighting paralyzed river traffic, but the airline could fly right over the difficulties.
And at this time, too, you had a lot of interesting people. You have so many people, Sun Qingling, and I may not be pronouncing these names correctly, so if I need to be corrected, don't hesitate to do so. That was the widow of Sun Yat-sen?
That's correct, Song Qingling. And she, you know, Madam Sun Yat-sen is sort of how she's generally known to history. And the three Song sisters were all big players in the nationalist era. You know, Song Mei-ling is Madam Chiang Kai-shek. She married Chiang Kai-shek. And then Song A-ling is Madam Kung, Madam H.H. Kung. And those three sisters were extremely influential and important and powerful political figures in China in the 1930s and 40s.
In 1933, there was a man by the name of Harold Bixby. He was working with Bond directly, and he said that Pan American Airways had taken control of Curtiss Wright's 45% in the China National Aviation Corporation. Now, this agreement with the China National Aviation Corporation was quite unusual, because this was a foreign percentage that was less. Usually the foreigners got more of a percentage, but Curtiss Wright took the lesser positioning, and until Bond got over there, they were really losing a lot of money.
Yeah, that's true, and That's actually crucial to the whole period, is that the American interest was always a minority interest. They had first Curtiss Wright, and then Pan Am bought Curtiss Wright's share. They had 45% of the airline, and the Chinese had 55% of it. So that it was a Chinese company always. And that was crucial to Pan Am, because Pan Am, their great commercial endeavor in the 1930s was transoceanic commercial flying, right? They wanted to fly the Pacific and carry mail and passengers across it. Now, and it was a tremendous technological accomplishment. You know, they flew from San Francisco to Hawaii to Midway to Wake to Guam to Manila. And then they wanted to fly from the Philippines to China, and it had to be Shanghai, because only Shanghai, of all the cities in the Orient, it was the only one that had the economic muscle to anchor a Trans-Pacific airline and make it profitable, right? So when Pan Am bought into CNAC, they were hoping to buy into the Chinese end of the line, and they wanted to land their airplanes in China. Now, the Chinese would not grant Pan Am the right to land their own airplanes in China, the right to land American-flagged airplanes in China, because of the most favored nation clauses and all the treaties that the foreign nations had signed with China in the 19th century. This is another one of the Opium War concessions that Britain got. And a most favored nation thing means that if China grants any commercial concession to any company, that same concession automatically extends to companies from any of the other treaty signatories, which means that if China granted the right to land American-flagged airplanes in China, they also granted it to every other foreign power that had signed a treaty with China, and that meant Japan, and that included Japan, and there was no way that China was going to grant that right to an American company if it meant Japan could land planes in China. It was totally non-negotiable. And Bixby and Pan Am didn't really appreciate that when they bought in, and they had to come up with a pretty interesting way of finessing it, which they did by meeting in Hong Kong, right, which was actually a British colony at the time. So Pan Am flew to Manila and then flew to Hong Kong, and CNAC, the China National Aviation Corporation, flew the route from Shanghai down to Hong Kong. The two planes met in that neutral territory, and then the Pan Am passengers would fly the rest of the way to Shanghai on CNAC.
I was fascinated, and this is digressing just a little bit, but it's in your book, about how the Dowager Empress had asked the Americans, or actually the airline, to take care of their postal service, because they were just... this is what you wrote, which I just loved. Foreigners were offensive, crude, uncultured, rude, and hairy, but they squeezed less money from the mail service than the Chinese themselves. And so she wanted the airlines to handle the important post offices.
Yeah, well, it wasn't the airlines. It was just foreigners in general, foreign businessmen, because they were less corrupt than their Chinese equivalent, right? So they sent the money that they were supposed to send back to, you know, Peking, got remitted to the central government. So she put them in charge because they stole less money from the mail service.
You made the comment about, well, actually write quite a bit about the war when it began. Of course, the Japanese had attacked. You talk about Bloody Saturday, bombings killing 1,740 civilians. There's just so much amazing detail about what started to happen. The time frame is July 7, 1937, and it just makes you realize that this is something that you didn't hear very much in the news about. And here is this airline, a lifeline for the lives of thousands and thousands of people, because all of this activity was just unbelievably devastating to the Chinese population.
Yeah, well, you know, after the... Marco Polo Bridge incident, which is in July of 1937, you know, a full-scale war breaks out between Japan and China, and there is a huge battle fought in Shanghai in the last half of 1937. For sure, the biggest battle fought in the world between the end of the First World War and, say, Stalingrad in the middle of the Second. And it nearly destroyed CNAC because, you know, they were driven from their hub at Shanghai, and it nearly broke the partnership between the Americans and the Chinese, because we were neutral, and our neutrality laws in the 1930s wouldn't allow us to serve on either side in a war, regardless of who had aggressed upon who. So Pan Am was sort of forced to withdraw from CNAC for 4, 5, 6 months, and Bond very, you know, diligently and persistently kind of forced the Americans back into the partnership. That's one of the cruxes of the story.
This is Donna Sebo. My guest today is Gregory Crouch. We're talking about his phenomenal historical book called China's Wings, and it just covers so many things. We're going to be taking a break. When we come back, we'll be talking a little bit about the Flying Tigers and some of the other things that evolved. The link between America and China is a lot more than what you could have ever imagined, all because of the aviation industry. We're going to be back in just a moment. China's Wings will be continuing in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. My guest today is Gregory Crouch. We're talking about his phenomenal book, China Wings, War, Intrigue, Romance, Adventure. By golly, you'll have that and a lot more, and it's all true. Yes, Gregory has just written, in my mind's eye, such a phenomenal book because he has so many points of information about different parts of the world, how America and the Chinese ended up in an alliance in the early days of aviation. Gregory, when we were off air, we were talking about, for a little bit, a phenomenal pilot, Moon Chin. And this man is still alive. And you said you saw him just a couple of weeks ago. He was one of this exceptional group of aviators that, in my mind's view, and I mentioned this to you, reminded me of the bush pilots of Alaska. They would fly in conditions that the average pilot wouldn't even touch. And the things that they accomplished, the lives they saved, the supplies they were able to get to people that were starving to death. And I mean, this is just, it keeps you gripped. When you start reading, you don't want to put the book down.
Well, thank you. It's a fabulous adventure. And you mentioned Moon, and Moon Chin is one of the most amazing men I've ever had the honor of meeting. He just celebrated on April 13th his 98th birthday.
And oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he's a marvelous man, and he came to a book signing I did in San Francisco in March, which was one of the highlights of my life. And you know, such a great honor to sort of put one of these books in his hands, and especially, you know, I'd taken up dozens and dozens of hours of his time through the years, kind of combing over the details of this story. But you know, he rose from, you know, he was born a barefoot peasant in an obscure South China village, and he rose to own one of his own airlines after the Second World War. And that's got to be the most unlikely life arc of the 20th century.
Well, he's incredible. These pilots were dealing with weather conditions that people just can't even imagine, and you go into a great deal of detail with that. You also talk about how important the mechanics were because of the environment and the conditions. And this is something that I have heard stated by more than one family person, that their dad was a mechanic in World War II. And they would say, people have no idea. They would pull things together, put planes together. They weren't supposed to fly, but they did.
Yeah. Well, CNAC was famous for improvisations. You know, they were on the furthest flung frontier of commercial aviation in the 1930s and 40s. And probably their most famous improvisation is the DC-2.5, where they had a wing blown off by a bomb on the ground of a DC-3, and they did not have a replacement DC-3 wing. The nearest DC-3 wing was at the Douglas factory in Santa Monica. And so they attached a DC-2 wing to the DC-3 and flew it in regular service, even though, you know, it was 5.5 feet shorter with much less lifting surface. And they flew that with a full load of cargo and passengers.
There's a number of humorous moments in your story. One is how they had to fly people out and they could only take so much weight. And this one flight, there was a woman by the name of Maj, I believe. It's M-A-J.
Yeah,
and
Madge.
Madge, okay. And she had her suitcase loaded, and they said, sorry, you've got too much weight. And how she had to take out an evening gown, and it was her boyfriend's favorite, and she dumped it, and off she went.
Well, yeah, and the crux of that story is that her boyfriend, Hugh Woods, he was the guy in charge of the departure scales. So he was the one telling her that she couldn't fly with just a bare fraction more than the 10-kilogram allotment.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of held the dress up for his inspection, and then you know, dropped it on the oily concrete and sort of stormed off into the airplane. And this was during the Hong Kong evacuation. It was, you know, the first night after Pearl Harbor. CNAC was flying evacuation flights from Hong Kong, and she got out on one of those flights. And that's another fabulously dramatic part of the story.
Right.
They ended up having a great marriage, Madge Woods and Hugh Woods. You know, they did get married after that, and they, you know, were inseparable. Apparently they died about 3 weeks apart from each other, you know, I think in the early 70s.
Love stories permeate through this with all of these people. And there is, I think, such an amazing collection of photography here. You have William Langhorn Bond's photo, his wife, Catherine Dunlop Bond. You have Ernie Allison, who was an incredible flyer. You just have so much here. And when you're looking at this, my thought is, my gracious, this would make a wonderful movie. But
well,
you have to have
the God's ear.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, really, all of this, this is a world that doesn't exist anymore.
You know,
plane,
it really doesn't.
Everything.
And I have a fabulous collection of CNAC photos because of my close association with all, you know, the survivors and their sons and daughters and wives. And they've all been very, very generous, you know, giving me photographs. And I've fed many more than are in the book here I've fed onto my website, and I also have a China's Wings Facebook page with a couple, maybe 120 pictures on there that are extra and stuff. So it's all been, it's really fun to sort through the photos of that era. And, you know, the pilots, they took more pictures of their airplanes than their girlfriends.
That's true. They do.
Yeah.
They do. Absolutely do. The stories about the pilots, the women, the politicians, what went on in the United States, the political positioning of the United States. This is history that has such a phenomenal richness to it that I think every high school student in their history class should be made aware of these facts, because it shows, number one, we had had alliances with China, and because of Mr. Bond, there was a phenomenal cooperation during some of the most difficult times that that nation went through because of the invasions and other things that were going on. You talk about the people of China, what affected them. There's so much here. How long did it take you to write this book?
I was on the job for 8 years, Donna, and when I first started, I thought I was eating a cow, and then after a couple years, I thought, well, it's, you know, really an elephant, and after a couple more years of that, it was, oh my God, it's a blue whale, and then after a couple more years, I'd finally got that whale choked down to the tail, and I had a hard time getting the tail in, but finally did, and you know, building on what you say about the American-Chinese partnership, you know, this airline, the China National Aviation Corporation, is without doubt the most successful Sino-American partnership that's ever existed. And, you know, it's something, it's an example that we would do well to be able to draw on today. It would be nice, you know, the Chinese government and the American government could learn a lot from this airline.
I think so, and the Flying Tigers ended up evolving out of a lot of what went on with CNAC, but also what I think is one of the most profound statements that you made about William Bond is that he was a man who was a problem solver, and he supported his family financially, had a wonderful family, and I'll use your words exactly. He set an example of how a man comports himself with discipline, dedication, responsibility, and honor. Few have the courage to match. He was a man, and he stands tall upon his accomplishments. I know in our time together we haven't been able to even scratch the surface of what this man accomplished, but there's so much in your book that makes for such a fascinating read. I just think you have done an incredibly good job with this. And again, I think it should be a must-read for just about anyone. So we understand how associations were, and as you mentioned a moment ago, how we can improve upon them. What is your website, Gregory?
Greg Crouch, GregCrouch.com.
And you said you have a Facebook page.
I do. There's a China's Wings Facebook page that anybody is welcome to like and peruse the photos that I have posted there.
With doing this book, what was the most significant impact that it had upon you as an individual? This is 8 years of your life.
Well, it essentially took over my life. And, you know, Bond has been a real example to me. I would like to live like that. You know, it's impossible to overstate the difficulties that his family circumstances endured for that time. And Bond and his wife, Kitsy, had a good marriage. They endured these terrible circumstances of war and separation for 8 years, you know, twice as long as everybody else or all other Americans endured, and their marriage prospered. You know, they were inseparable after the war, and you know, they raised two sons. One of their sons, Thomas Dunlop Bond, he emailed me, I think yesterday, and had said, you know, sort of thanking me for writing the book and saying what a good job a good portrait or an accurate portrait of her, his father, he thought it was. And I really have enjoyed my association with his two sons. You know, the whole thing has been very influential on my life, and I'm just amazed at how much I learned about, you know, China and about this company and about the American relationship in the Far East. And it's a very rich milieu.
I agree. Well, I know we're out of time, Gregory. For those of you listening, I would sincerely encourage you to go and get the book, China's Wings. Greg Crouch has his own website, and you could check that out, gregcrouch.com. Also on Facebook, China's Wings. Check it out. It will amaze you, the information that he's put together. And as I said before, it's mesmerizing. You won't want to put it down. Gregory Crouch, thank you so much for being my guest today. It was a delight having you. And we're sharing the book with as many people as we possibly can, because I think it's a part of American history and Chinese history that it's wonderful that you took on the project, dedicated 8 years of your life to making it happen, and that we can hold it in our hands and read it.
Well, thank you very much, Donna. It's been my pleasure, too. I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
Have a wonderful life, and when you write your next book, in about 10 years, let me know.
Hopefully it won't take that long.
I hope so, too, Gregory. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959 1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Well, I'm here in the Big Apple. Oh, is it beautiful? I'm telling you, New York is so invigorating, but you got to make sure you have your walking shoes on. You walk everywhere in this city. It's incredible, and I'm so delighted to be here. I had a fabulous afternoon here at the National Publicity Summit. I interviewed close to 100 people, and we're going to be having as a guest on the Donna Sebo Show some fascinating individuals that I've interviewed today. I also want to let you know that we've got the new showtime. That's right, don't forget. On May 1st, the Donna Sebo Show will be on from 9 to 10 in the morning, so be sure to make a note of that so that you don't miss any of the wonderful guests that I have. Telephone lines are now open. If you'd like to give me a call, I'd be delighted to light your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Buzz me at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Well, next week we are going to have a terrific lineup of people, and let me just give you a little bit of information about who's coming up. On Monday, we're going to be talking with Anne Gerkrich. She is a woman who not only battled cancer, but also was very much involved with rescuing dogs in the Katrina event. Well, we're going to be hearing from her. We're also going to be talking about how you can master and attain a healthy self-image. We are going to be talking about quantum Map Thinking by James Mape, and then Soul Shift by Mark Ireland. We're going to be talking about a world-renowned psychic. That'll be a week from today. It was Mark's father, a man that I didn't know anything about, but by golly, I've learned, and he is fascinating. All of this information about upcoming guests will be up on the BBS website by the first of the month, so you will know more about what these wonderful people that are coming up next month will have to share with you. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat at 888-627-6008. Well, I have a delightful poem. It's a little short one on the month of April. And this is by Sandy Paisley, and the most exquisite tulip is in front of me with this beautiful image. And this is what she wrote. Raindrops, tiny prisms of light, fall like diamonds from the sky across the fields of April. And that's the way it is. I don't know about your neighborhood, but tulips are blooming. And, of course, in the Pacific Northwest, we have fields and fields and fields of them that go on for as far as the eye can see in Mount Vernon and La Conner, Washington, and they're absolutely gorgeous. Well, not only are the tulips gorgeous, but the lilacs, all kinds of wonderful, wonderful flowers are coming out. And between now and June, lilacs, they have the most incredible fragrance, and they are so beautiful. Well, they are coming out too, and you know, when they start to bloom, the fragrance is just absolutely awesome. And, of course, this is a good time maybe if you wanted to pick up a few lilac plants. They grow prolifically. All they need to do is be put in a place where they get a little bit of tender, loving care and good amount of water, and my goodness, you will have a plant that will be around you for a long time. Well, Donna Sebo, give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. I wanted to share some thoughts with you because so many times people get so concerned about life that they forget that kindness can go a long way. And sometimes when we're in the dumps, people come out of the blue and make us recognize that we really, really need to be more mindfully present about being grateful for our lives, but more than that, accepting good when it comes our way. There was a woman by the name of Roxanne. She lived in a part of the country where they got intense rains. It was so bad that her apartment flooded. She said just about everything was damaged. Everything was going to have to be replaced. And she was so down in the dumps, she went to where she was working. It happened to be a restaurant. And she, of course, told her coworkers what happened. And it was a few days later, she was shocked to find in an envelope that her boss handed her $200. She was stunned. She thought it was from him, and she started to thank him. He said, "No, not me. There was a customer in the restaurant that overheard you talking about the flood, and she wanted to help you get back on your feet." To this day, Roxanne does not know who that guardian angel of $200 was, but she said she just wants her to know, whoever she was, what she did really made a difference in Roxanne's life. More than anything else, Roxanne was made aware of the fact, one, people care, two, possessions can be replaced, and three, don't ever give up hope, because you never know what opportunity might be right there in front of you. And when you get your good, whatever that good, whatever form that good comes in, be grateful for it. And another thing, sometimes you need to remember it so one day maybe you can pass along to someone else the good that was shared with you in one form or another. This is Donna Sebo. We are out of time. I'm so grateful that we shared the airwaves today, and I look forward to talking with you on Monday. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, life is rich. It is good. It has a lot of things to be grateful for. And if you're going through some challenges, well, don't we all? But there are challenges that you can overcome. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo in the Big Apple. I'll be talking to you back in the Pacific Northwest on Monday. Take care. Have a fabulous weekend. Be safe. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.